Hey, welcome to Weekly Corner Speaky. It is myself, Nick, and I am joined with our Austria expert, you know, pal over in Vienna, Adam Baltner. Hey, Adam, how's it going?
It's going pretty well. The vibes have been particularly good this week in the Alpine Republic.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. I asked you on actually quite last minute because of the recent, for me, it was surprising results of, the Austrian, like local, like what would be like is it like the Landtagswahl? Like what would be the equivalent of it? Like the local elections in Salzburg?
Gemeinderatswahl. So the city of Salzburg.
Everything has a different name, but it always has an equal equivalent of it in German.
What would a Gemeinderatswahl be referred to in Germany? Do they have a special name for it?
Oh yeah, isn't that like because Salzburg's a state in a city, right? Like,
There's a city Salzburg and there's a state Salzburg, but they're not contiguous with each other. So yeah. Vienna is both a city and a state. The city and the state have the same borders, but there's a municipal government. There are municipal governing and administrative structures, and then there are also state governing and municipal structures. But Salzburg is like analogous to New York. You know, there's New York City and then there's New York State. And New York City is in New York State, but they're two different things. That's what Salzburg is like.
Yeah, and so this was for then the smaller.
This was for the city.
Yes.
So the election that happened Sunday was the city council election in the city of Salzburg. Not just the city council election. There was also a mayoral election, which we'll get to in a minute.
Yeah, so this would be like a Staatsrat, I think, in Germany, like if I'm not like mistaken. And depending on how big your city is, these can actually be of quite importance locally. I mean, to be very fair, I'm very much of the opinion, I think, that then that you're, I mean, we see this in Berlin, your local politic is definitely the one that then affects you the most. And so going into then this, like, again, I said last time that we spoke, we kind of talked briefly about then the left and the KPÖ, but the KPÖ plus, KPÖ plus, the KPÖ plus, we briefly mentioned was like this merging of the Greens and the Communist Party, and they were kind of having little, you know, successes here and there. Graz is a city that then is also actually where the Communists control the mayoralship, and in Salzburg they had quite an impressive result. But how did we get here? Because last time we talked, you weren't too optimistic, to say the least, about the KPÖ, and now, you know, 20. I think what is it? It was over 20% in the results in Salzburg. Out of nowhere, you know, posting up near W's, could get the mayorship, you know.
Yeah. So I think it was actually the first time that I came on Corner Späti. If I remember correctly, it was in early 2020, and I came on to talk about the new federal governing coalition between, or so it's the new national government between the ÖVP, which is the Austrian Conservative Party, basically they're called the Austrian People's Party, and the Greens. So I did some analysis of that conservative green federal coalition, talked about the prospects for that, and also the possibilities for left-wing resistance, for pushing against the new regime from the left. And I mentioned that I was a member of the KPÖ, the Communist Party of Austria. And at the time, the KPÖ was a party that really only had regional significance in the state of Styria, which has the capital city of Graz, which is the second biggest city in Austria. And when I say it was significant in Styria, it had won 6% in the last Landtagswahl. So the last state election, the communists had won 6%, which was enough for two members of the Styrian Landtag. I'm not quite sure how many members the Styrian Landtag has in total. I think it has something like 40 or 50 members. So the communists managed to win two seats in that body. And then in the city of Graz, in their most recent election, the KPÖ had won just over 20%, which is, you know, very respectable. And they'd even managed to finish in second place, but they were still an opposition party. They were in opposition to a far-right coalition in the city of Graz. So a coalition between the far right Freedom Party of Austria, or FPÖ, and the conservative ÖVP. And I think I justified my being in the, you know, I don't know, I've always been the kind of person who's sort of a joiner. Like I've liked, I feel like if I call myself a socialist or a communist, like I should be organized in some capacity. Even, you know, if I haven't had much time to actively organize, I think there is some value in sort of orienting yourself towards an organization and at least paying dues so you can materially support people who are actually engaging in some form of activism, trying to change things in some way. And, you know, I've always kind of been inclined towards, you know, sort of revolutionary optimism, I guess you could call it. You know, at the time I knew that the KPÖ were, you know, irrelevant on the national stage. I mean, this is a party that had gotten less than 1% in the last national election, that had gotten less than 1% in most state level elections and city level elections that they've even chose, that they had even chose to run on around that same time period. But I sort of thought, you know, there's really nothing better on the Austrian political scene. And I did see what was going on in Graz, and I found, you know, the approach of the comrades there to be very inspiring. You know, it was very oriented towards helping working people in whatever limited capacity the party could. And that approach, you know, very small scale sort of grassroots approach, sort of base building approach, had started to bear some fruit. And it had even made the KPÖ the second strongest party in the second biggest city in Austria, which, you know, counts for something, I think. Anyway, fast forward a year and a half, 2021, the ÖVP, which had the mayor's office, which was the ruling party in the city of Graz at the time, along with the far right FPÖ, they called there was an election slated for the spring of 2022 at the latest. I think that was the latest that the election legally had to be held, because then it would have been 5 years since the most recent city council election. But the ÖVP saw sort of an opportunity to profit by calling a snap election. So at the time, the far right Freedom Party of Austria was coming off a massive scandal nationally. They had been tossed out of the national of a right far right coalition on the national level after a major scandal, which I'm sure a lot of listeners will be familiar with, involving the then leader of the far right, a character named Hatze Strache. You know, the Ibiza scandal, as it's known.
Yeah, and, where you you know, you just fall victim to the, you know, sexy Russian honeypot, and
that's right, you
know, end up destroying your party.
That's right. So just to give a brief background on this for people who might not know what I'm talking about. I mean, if you don't know what I'm talking about, you should probably pause the episode and look at the Wikipedia page. But
or listen to our episode that we did about it somewhere. Yeah.
Or listen to the Corner Späti episode.
That's better. Yeah.
That definitely exists. So during the 2017 federal election campaign, a secret video, a sting operation was set up where an actress pretending to be a Russian oligarch basically got went partying with the head of the FPÖ, this guy named Hatze Strache, and they were filmed. It appeared that that Hatze Strache was visibly drunk and possibly on other drugs, and he negotiated, or he was filmed negotiating a deal with this actress slash supposed Russian oligarch to have her buy the biggest boulevard newspaper in Austria and basically turn it into an FPÖ campaign vehicle. And this would be done in exchange for, I don't know, some sort of quid pro quo, maybe financial benefits to this person or to her family or whatever. Anyway, this video footage ended up being leaked to the press in 2019. So this is almost 2 years into the governing coalition between the right and the far right. And this caused a massive scandal and ended up with Hatze Strache resigning. He was the vice chancellor at the time. He resigned from vice chancellorship and resigned from resigned from his chairmanship of the FPÖ, and retired from all political, or I guess retired for the time being from all political activity and all functions that he held. And the FPÖ, without their sort of leading light, took a massive hit in the polls. They were shown to be just as corrupt as all the other parties. This is a party that, you know, basically their whole pitch to the, I mean, a big part of their pitch is that all the other parties are corrupt, that all the other parties don't care about, you know, the common man. They're the only ones who really know what it's like for, you know, just regular, you know, the regular guy, the common man, the little guy. But clearly this was shown to be just bullshit. You know, when you get this video, this politician just partying it up with this oligarch and, you know, promising to manipulate the media in order to, you know, just gain power for his own party. Anyway, so after this scandal, the FPÖ was polling really poorly. And the ÖVP, you know, at the time, as is still the case on the federal level, so, you know, a few years after a year after the scandal had happened, you know, there was a snap election and then they enter into a governing coalition with the Greens. And basically the ÖVP, or at least what I believe is that the ÖVP in Graz, saw an opportunity to kick, the FPÖ, their junior partners in the city of Graz, out of government in Graz and maybe form a similar coalition, as existed on the federal level with the Green Party. Maybe they saw them as, you know, better for, the ÖVP saw the Greens as potentially better for their own public image. They wanted to get them out. Anyway, the snap election was scheduled for November 2021, and the ÖVP was pretty certain that they would win, that they would win by a lot, and that they would be able to sort of enter into a nice, easy coalition where they were the, you know, by far the majority partner, and then they had sort of the Greens as a small minority partner, and they could basically run roughshod over the Greens, get the Greens to agree to whatever they wanted, and they wouldn't have this image problem of being associated with this, you know, extremely, you know, scandal-disgraced far-right party. Anyway, things didn't work out as planned. To everybody's surprise, the Communist Party of Austria actually ended up finishing in first in the snap election in Graz, held in September 2021. You know, I can speak from the perspective of the party and of my comrades in Graz. They were all shocked the evening of the election when the results, when they're watching the results come in on live TV, they were just as surprised as everybody else. And, you know, it was a pretty wild time in KPÖ circles. And the ÖVP, so the KPÖ, the communist one with something like 28% of the vote, the ÖVP went from, you know, I think in the previous election, they had got almost 40% of the vote or 35% of the vote. They dropped down to the mid-20s. They got about 25% of the vote. Then the Greens got 15, then the FPÖ, no, it was the Greens were around 15%. The SPÖ was around 10%. The FPÖ was also around 10%. SPÖ is Social Democrats, as most listeners will probably know. And then everybody else, you know, finished with less than that. And this was enough for a left-wing coalition in the city of Graz led by the communists, which is the current government in Graz. So it's a communist-led government in coalition with the Greens and the SPÖ. So, you know, red, red, green. I know that the German should be familiar with the concept of red, red, green. But usually when you hear about red, red, green in Germany, it's like, oh, you know, maybe if the SPÖ and the Greens do really well and they're really nice to Die Linke kind of sucks up to them, maybe they'll let Die Linke be like super minority partner.
Not that like Die Linke coming in with this like, yeah, you have to work with us. I feel that then, every Axel Springer held publication would like, you know, commit suicide or something, like, you know, all like drink the Kool-Aid like simultaneously. Just like, I cannot imagine a scenario like that in Germany at all. So
like red, red, green, where Die Linke were the majority, where the majority part or the senior partner and everybody else was the junior partner. That's how people in Austria felt, because I mean for decades Austria has been seen and justifiably so as sort of the pioneer of right-wing populism. You know, the FPÖ started to achieve poll numbers back in the 1980s that the AfD in Germany is achieving now. You know, they started to pull in the teens and even the 20s. And then there was a government, a right far right government that was inaugurated in 2000 and ruled from 2000 to 2008 in two separate terms. So, you know, people in Germany are really afraid about the prospect of an AfD government right now. You know, for us in Austria, we've already basically had the equivalent to this, it was a different era and circumstances were, of course, slightly different. But, Austria,
it was the early 2000s. Everyone was trying out these kooky coalitions. What about if we had an SPD green coalition thing for a minute that really liked war or pretends that they don't, but yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's like good to hear or not of that it was a surprise to even the party itself, but that's at least so they go into this coalition and Gratz has not burnt down completely to the ground, as I guess every right wing publication would assume. So how has then, I guess, like this? Well, I guess it's now 2 years of governing been then for the communist led coalition then in Gratz, because I guess this must be tied into then their success with the recent successes as well.
On balance, it's been very positive, especially if you look at the amount of support that the government has. So the amount of support, from all available polling data and other sort of more anecdotal evidence suggests that the support for the KPÖ in Graz has only increased since they've taken the mayor's office.
But that's because they've taken control of all the pollings and it's like Stalinist numbers of, 98% approval rate,
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We've abolished the bourgeois press and set up. everybody has to have, state media, the television turned on in their home at all time, playing state media. You can turn the volume down a little, but it always has to be. No, the KPÖ, since they've gotten into office, they've actually had some major challenges. First and foremost, the major budget deficit that the ÖVP left them with. The ÖVP the ÖVP had been the mayor party in Graz since the early 2000s. And during that time, their governance was mostly marked by sort of massive public spending dedicated to sort of prestige development projects, massive investment in sort of prestige, buildings, or building a gondola up to this proposed gondola project. They wanted to build a gondola up to the mountain that overlooks that's in the center of the city in Graz. They've basically been operating a very investor friendly government, sort of attracting investment from real estate firms. There's been a lot of real estate speculation, also a lot of sort of the green spaces in Graz that were, sort of public spaces have been, paved over. And, I guess in the United States, we might speak of something like urban sprawl, sort of like unregulated, unrestrained development, which, was popular for a while because, stuff like that does create jobs. But if you have, this speculative bubble of real estate, then that also hurts people financially. That hurts everyday people too. So this will, and if you're constantly just, paving over green spaces that people like to, spend their free time in, this is also going to start getting on people's nerves. So if you're seen as just being more friendly to, major construction corporations, then I don't know, the person receiving, welfare, or the person working a minimum wage job, then that's not gonna be beneficial to you in the long term. So these are all factors that contributed to the ÖVP's collapse. But because of all the public spending that went into funding and financing these prestige projects, the KPÖ inherited a pretty screwed up budget, which really wasn't helped by the subsequent economic developments, particularly after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So the KPÖ has really had to, sort of find ways to fix some of the messes that the URFLP left them with. But they've also managed to do so in a way that they haven't forced, you know, workers to pay the bill on, you know, that the URFLP left them with. So one thing that the KPÜ did basically right after winning the election, they announced that, so in German, you would say like Betriebskostenerhöhung. So like every year, the costs of things like, you know, like municipal services, you know, the cost of, you know, like the basically like the
amenities and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, the taxes, that the money that you have to pay for amenities, that are, and these prices are set. The costs are set by the city. The company said we're not doing the standard. You know, usually every year there's a they raise the costs of the municipal services, in order to keep up with inflation. The KPÜ said, you know, we're not going to do that this year. This year, we're just not going to raise any of those costs because, you know, given the current economic climate, working people already have to do enough belt tightening. We're not going to foist that onto them now. And they've also continued to do sort of the kind of things that they've always been doing. They host these office hours where they meet with constituents and they provide direct aid to people in need. And they, you know, they do things like lowering the, you know, the public transportation costs. There's something called it's called the Sozial card, the social card, which basically is this card that people with lower incomes receive from the city. And it entitles them to things like free public transportation and access to, you know, other social services at discounts. So the KPÜ basically raised the minimum income level that you need in order to receive the social card, things like that.
These sound unreal compared to Berlin. I mean, I know that Graz is much smaller and stuff like that. There is definitely, I mean, also, you know, plenty of other things adding into it. But that is, by no surprise, then, you know, politics and policy that then clearly affect working class people are going to be well received. That I don't understand how this seems to be such particularly, I don't know, at least, you know, noticing in the sense of when, like, the social democratic led red green in Berlin had control, it was, you know, let's, you know, do the most, you know, neoliberal, you know, market-based solution kind of bullshit that you can possibly imagine, instead of just like, hey, yeah, access to these things from the get-go is just something that makes more sense to provide, you know. I mean, yeah, the transportation, I mean, just things that, yeah, then I know that I interact with then on a daily basis, having easier access to them, or having more money to your in like, you know, more money like monthly would seem like the best places to start with for policy.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and another thing I didn't even mention yet is you know, they're literally building more public housing. You know, I mean, even in Vienna, like, Vienna is really famous for its public housing system, and the public housing system is really good. But Vienna hasn't. So Vienna recently instituted this sort of new model of public housing, which is slightly less social than the others. Like, there are all these issues with, you know, some of the construction is state funded, but then a lot of the housing stock is sort of open to potentially being privatized at some point in the future. And Graz, they're just, you know, building public housing, which is pretty incredible, I think.
So then fast forward to then from, you know, the Graz political experiment, I guess I'm just going to call it now because it seems so unreal to me, to then now where we have then, it seems like the influence of the Communist Party, or isn't really so much of a fluke, but that it seems like that this is a party to be contended with coming into that Austria has, they have also a federal election this well, and there's also the European elections. And what other elections are this well in Austria as well, too, if I'm missing any? I know there's this one in, there's also a mayor election coming up soon for Salzburg.
Mm-hmm. This year, I'll talk about the elections this year really quick. So the first round of elections was last Sunday, and that was actually, it was both the city council in the city of Salzburg, but also the mayoral election in Salzburg. In order to be elected mayor in Salzburg, you need over 50% of the vote. And since there were something like 7 or 8 candidates, nobody got over 50%.
It goes to a second round then, right?
Yeah. In 2 weeks, in 1 week now, there's going to be the runoff election. And the candidates in the runoff election are the SPÖ, the Social Democrat candidate, a guy named Bernhard Auinger, who received 29.5% of the vote, and then the KPÖ candidate, Kai-Michael Danke, who received 28% of the vote. We have to assume that Auinger probably has the edge here. I assume, a lot of conservative voters will tend towards the Social Democrat rather than the Communists, but, who knows? I wouldn't necessarily put my money on either one. After Salzburg, there's going to be another city council election in the city of Innsbruck. And Innsbruck is the one city in Austria with higher rental prices than Salzburg. So Salzburg has the second highest cost of living for renters, and Innsbruck is the number one highest rents in the country. The KPÖ has traditionally been very... Innsbruck has not been a stronghold traditionally for the KPÖ. Basically, all of Western Austria has been traditionally dominated by the conservatives. And this has to do with historical factors. It's traditionally more rural. A lot of the economy, historically at least, has revolved around sort of agriculture. So a lot of farmers, a lot of, landowners, big landowners, and not necessarily a lot of industry, at least, things like manufacturing and heavy industry,
These are the areas of Austria when we think of this is the Alps. This is
where you go on vacation. Yeah. When you go to Austria on vacation, you go to Western Austria.
Innsbruck is one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen in my life, but it's very clearly it is. In the mountains, right at the base of them, more or less.
It's
these idyllic sceneries that you'd also associate, I guess, with Bayern or Bavaria in Germany as well, too. So,
exactly. And, even the Social Democrats have never, they've historically been a non-factor in the west of Austria as well. Historically, it's been the conservatives all the way down. More recently, you've started to see the conservatives lose some voters to the Greens and lose other voters to the far right, the Freedom Party. Innsbruck is interesting, though, for the KPÖ, because although the KPÖ, there aren't really, or until quite recently, there weren't very well-established party structures, there weren't a lot of activists on the ground. This has started to change, actually, in the last few years, and the KPÖ has a pretty young woman in her mid-30s named Pia Tomedi is the Spitzenkandidatin, so the main candidate or the first candidate on the KPÖ list, and she is a social worker by profession, she has also been a longtime housing activist, she's really been involved on this issue of housing, which is also the KPÖ's sort of bread and butter issue. It was their bread and butter issue in Graz for decades, and then more recently in Salzburg. And since Innsbruck is so, since the cost of living there the cost of living crisis, if it's hit anywhere in Austria hard, it's especially hit Innsbruck hard. So the KPÖ might have sort of also in the election is in April, but the KPÖ might experience some sort of unprecedentedly good results in that city. But, I don't want, we'll see basically. So after Innsbruck, there's the EU elections. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the EU elections because, this gets sort of into, sort of more recent KPÖ history a bit. Historically, the KPÖ has, you know, the issue of the EU has been hotly contested within the party and how the party should relate to it, you know, into the 90s and the 2000s. You know, there were a lot of comrades, and even today, maybe a lot of comrades who were, you know, very, very critical of the EU and even thought, you know, our party shouldn't really have anything to do with it. You know, we had a, you know, left wing critique of the EU. You know, it's a tool of, you know, it basically facilitates the international flow of capital. It's, you know, it's not, it doesn't exist to, you know, improve the lives of working people. It exists to facilitate the flow of capital. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, it really, yeah. I mean, it really is the, I mean, I think they, it is the line on that we very much have on the show of that, then that the European Union is strictly a first and foremost an economic union that then has been trying to like mold itself into actual policy making. I mean, it does make policy. I guess it makes the legal structure of economic activity in this, where it's like you have to be a capitalist market economy in the European Union. But yeah, like, I mean, I think that it's also like those debates of the past too, particularly in the sense of like Austria falls into a different relationship with the EU or with a lot of international organizations in general. Their participation in them isn't necessarily as so dire as, say, like a Germany, a France, or the UK, as we saw with Brexit. But at the same time, too, it's like Austria doesn't really like not benefit from them either, too, at the same time. They're also like, I don't feel that then it's like there was never really like a massive, like there was like Austria has like a bit of Euroscepticism in it internally within like its governing parties, of course, too. But at least from my knowledge, I never saw like any party really calling for like an exit. I don't know what would be an Austrian exit.
Yeah, an exit.
Exit. Yeah, there. Like, I don't think. Yeah, I don't even like. I can't even think of an Abquatsong for it. That's how I think non-existent that conversation is. Or am I completely wrong? And every party like wants to get out of the European Union. It was just kind of accepted, I feel, as like a constant. You
yeah,
know?
I mean, the FPÖ has been making some noises about how there should possibly be, or that mainly the FPÖ's current chairman has been making some noises about, you know, sort of flirting with the idea of an exit. But I don't think that's, I don't know how seriously we should necessarily take that, especially when you know a thing or two about the FPÖ's history. I mean, historically, at least until you know, if you look at the FPÖ in the 90s and the 2000s, like, you know, this party has historically been very, you know, pro EU and pro NATO. So,
yeah,
I mean, they've changed this recently in response. I mean, because they're intelligent when it comes to small p politics. You know, they've sort of seen the ways that the winds are blowing amongst popular opinion or among popular opinion.
Yeah.
Anyway, it'll be interesting to see what happens with, I mean, the KPÖ is running a campaign for EU parliament, and the top candidate on our list is actually our chairman, a guy named Günther Hopfgartner. But yeah, I think, the party hasn't really put out a lot of the party's sort of political communication. If you follow them in social media, whatever, follow the sort of interviews that candidates have doing, they haven't really been talking much about the EU election yet. It's going to be interesting to see how that changes as the election date approaches. I believe the elections are in June. Do you know?
I think they're in May, but yeah. European elections, though, like the European parliamentary elections come and go like super fast. Like, yeah, we cover them, but it's like, it's, yeah, it's, I think it's like a 5-week, like super fast election process throughout all of Europe. Mm-hmm. Well, but I mean like the lead up and everything. So because I haven't seen any parties in Germany either, like really. Mm-hmm. I mean, the FDP like released their candidate the other day, but that's the only, I mean, but they're, you know, losers. So,
like, yeah, I mean,
so, but yeah. And then Austria has a federal election too this year as well.
So after the EU election, then there's going to be a national election probably in September. So we're going to be voting on a new parliament. And currently the far right Freedom Party is pulling at close to 30% And the it sort of tied for second place are the Social Democrats and the Conservatives, who are both polling in the low 20s. Then you have the Greens polling, you know, maybe around 10%, and this Libertarian Party called the Neos. It's funny because
I forgot about the Neos.
There are equivalent to the FDP.
Yeah,
but I think it's funny that they call themselves the Neos because they're neoliberals. So it's very honest. You know, they get mad at us for calling ourselves communists. They're like, how could you name yourself after an ideology that has claimed that murdered 100 million people? You know, citing this like bullshit statistic from the Black Book of Communism, and it's like you literally name yourself after the ideology of Augusto Pinochet. You're like neoliberals and Margaret Thatcher. Like, I mean, I like no political tradition or ideological current has a monopoly on crimes, right? Neither on the left nor the right. Like you can.
I mean, just the thing about it is that then like liberals have never had to come face to face with, you know, maybe bad stuff that their ideology has been responsible for. But anyway, we're not here to get into the discussion the labeling of neoliberalism or whatever. Yeah. But that's hilarious that you would though like name your party in some way on a pun of neoliberalism. Like, wow. But
I think it's supposed to be like a vague acronym that stands for Das Neue Österreich, like the new Austria. And then so after the Neos, there's so the Neos and Greens are both polling around 10%. And then the KPU's polling around, according to recent polling, we're around 3%. We need 4% to get into parliament. I haven't seen any post-Salzburg polling, though. So there was after Graz happened, the next big KPU breakthrough was in 2023, last year. So Salzburg state had a state parliament election, Landtagswahl, and the KPU increased their vote share from 0.8% of the vote to 12% of the vote, which is totally unprecedented. So Salzburg, this generally conservative state, is all of a sudden the state where the Communist Party has the strongest representation, even stronger than in their traditional stronghold of Styria. So this was a massive breakthrough for the party. And in the weeks after that election, the KPU was polling around 5, 6, even 7% in some polls. So this is clearly like the post, you know, we got a lot, you know, our electoral breakthrough generated a lot of media attention, and that led to a greater consciousness. Oh, there's this other party that's offering, you know, a political alternative. We start to see our poll numbers go way up. I haven't seen any opinion polling after the most recent election in Salzburg City, but I would be interested to see how those, what effect those have on our polling. Whether the effects from Salzburg creates, you know, whether the current campaign in Innsbruck might end up benefiting from the success in Salzburg, and then whether that leads into sort of positive momentum going into the EU election, and then that leads into positive momentum going into the national election in September. So that's kind of that's like the optimistic scenario. In the optimistic scenario, like, you know, our good results in Salzburg sort of create this, you know, trigger this wave of momentum, basically create this dynamic, which sort of carries us on. And then I would say that a success for the KPU in the national election would be to get more than 4% and get into parliament. The KPU has not been in parliament in Austria since 1959. It's interesting. The KPU was one of the, they're one of the founding parties of the, so there are three founding parties of the Second Republic. The Second Republic, or the First Republic, was Austria between, you know, the fall of the Habsburg, the fall of Austria-Hungary in 1918, and the rise of Austro-fascism in 1934. So 1918 to 1934, you have the First Republic. Then after World War II, you have the Second Republic, which, you know, the occupying powers inaugurate in 1945. And the three parties that the occupying powers, you know, the Soviet Union, the United States, Russia, and France, name as the founding, their founding parties are the UVP, so the conservatives, the SPU, the center left, social democrats, and then the KPÖ. And the reason that they chose the KPÖ, you know, of course, this had to do with the fact that, you know, one of the allied powers was the Soviet Union, but also the KPÖ was the leading force in the armed resistance to both Austrofascism and the Nazi fascism after the Anschluss in 1938. After the Nazis were defeated in Austria, because of the role that the KPÖ had played, among other things, the party did enjoy, a well-earned reputational boost, I would say. And, you know, on the local level and even in the national parliament, they had not a lot of representation, but they had some representation. They were earning 5-6% in national elections, basically until the late 1950s when, the Cold War begins to escalate and the associations with communism become not as positive anymore. And you see them get kicked out of parliament. So if the KPÖ were to get over 4% of the election, that would be truly historic. You know, they'd be going back to parliament for the first time in 70 years.
So kind of then more back to, I mean, looking forward ahead to elections that are in possibly half a year, but is a bit, I don't want to, get us too giddy with excitement, just in optimism that may or may not be there. But how did then, because we've mentioned continuously on the show that the recent kind of current affairs with the war in Ukraine, the cost of living crisis, now the war in Gaza, especially too in Germany, has created a very, kind of perfect storm for a, party like the AfD to kind of grasp this moment. How did this happen, I guess, differently with the KPÖ? Because clearly there is, I mean, their politic and their party platform has been, admirable, especially in the sense that then their direct action to the community and stuff like that clearly has been effective. But clearly they are like the policy positions and regarding, the current, crisis of Europe must be attractive. So I guess then what are then the policies then of the KPÖ, especially in a country like Austria that then is one, not a NATO member and has a much different relation, I guess, to other European countries that I think people forget about, like, especially in the sense of like their relations with, Russia and stuff like that. How does this all play into the party platform?
Yeah, so I think for starters, immediately after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the KPÖ, executive put out a statement against weapons. Austria is constitutionally neutral, which means, after the Second Republic was founded, it was written into the constitution that Austria had to be neutral, wasn't allowed to participate in any military alliances, wasn't allowed to send material aid to a party involved in a war, and so on and so forth. And of course, this had to do with the politics of the Cold War and the negotiations that led to the founding of the Second Republic, the negotiations that occurred between, the Soviet Union and the Western allies, even still, the KPÖ was the only party, immediately after Russia invaded Ukraine, to put out a statement saying rejecting weapon shipments and even rejecting sanctions, rejecting the EU sanctions, and the argument that the party used was that by supporting, as an EU, these sanctions are, a tool of war. And as a member of the EU, we're therefore implicit in these sanctions. And this actually in conflict with Austria's constitutional neutrality. This is unconstitutional. So a very principled stance, also a very principled anti-war stance, and they did this while also condemning, war of aggression for what it was. You know, they're not the party is in no way like pro Putin or something. Of course, to your average bourgeois journalist, you know, they see the KPÖ criticizing weapon shipments and calling for a ceasefire, and they immediately start slinging mud, you know, saying, oh, these communists are all just completely backwards. They all love Putin. They think Putin is, you know, they love Putin because Putin used to be a communist, and they're communists, and they're all obsessed with Russia, just like they all used to be obsessed with the Soviet Union. And, you know, we have the typical sort of media offensive against the party. But the party, you know, stuck to its stances, you know, also, you know, in its statement, criticized the role of NATO and sort of creating the conditions, you know, that made something like this more likely, which I think, you know, is a totally, I mean, that's like a rational, level-headed analysis, I think, right? Like, yeah. I mean, nobody would, you know, I don't think to analyze something like that is to morally just, like, to analyze the historical factors that led to Putin's invasion aren't to say that his invasion was morally justified.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely not. It's just like being able to like point out the sense of 30 years of, you know, bad policy from, you know, both sides. And especially, I think, in the sense of then Austria also coming from this position just generally as not a member of the institution that then did worsen a lot of these conditions. Mm-hmm. I feel that then it's like a bit, is it easier to do as a non-NATO member?
Yeah. So like, yes. I think the KPÖ does have, you know, a couple structural historical advantages over a party like Die Linke, because of the, you know, constitutional differences between Austria versus, you know, the Federal Republic of Germany. So Austria is a constitutionally neutral country. The KPÖ can articulate what's basically a principled anti-imperialist position or anti-war position, but they can articulate this position by referring to the Austrian constitution. So they can almost position themselves as constitutional patriot. You know, we're anti-imperialist, but we're also the true defenders of the Austrian constitution. That's not something a party like Die Linke can do. I mean, Germany as a NATO member, you know, anybody who, I mean, maybe, you know, obviously you as somebody living in Germany knows more about this than I, but my impression from afar, not that far, but still, is that if you even criticize NATO in Germany, it's basically like the Verfassungsschutz, you know, you might end up on like some list or, you know, of the Verfassungsschutz or something. You know, it's almost like NATO is seen as part of, like if you're against NATO, it's almost like you're against the state.
Yeah, no, definitely. Like the feeling of Germany, especially because like all of these, I don't know, like staples of liberalism and whatnot, or something that Germany is so bound, maybe not constitutionally. I mean, Germany's not like constitutionally like bound to being a NATO member, but it kind of feels like it, you know. But it is also like the discussion too, along then the sense of then being anti-war, particularly amongst Die Linke. Like Die Linke is not really, I mean, like there's a you know, trend within the party itself too of, you know, being pro-NATO as well, that I guess there's also this thing of that if you're not already a part of it, you don't even need to have it as a discussion of that. Then do we support this thing? Do we not? Is it like, you know, is there the option of then like the ridiculous concept 2 years ago of like NATO becoming an anti-imperialist institution amongst like left wing, you know, groups was, I mean, now in hindsight, silly. I think that then like Die Linke has like changed its tune a bit. They are against weapon shipments and whatnot. So there is still, I mean, like the general policy seems to be quite similar. But yes, like you, like again, Die Linke is still also doing like 4 or 5%, may not even make it in the Bundestag, and is clearly now a very unpopular party, where the party that then in Germany, like I mentioned, who then is having this like, you know, push is again, yeah, the AfD and whatnot, which again is in some cases just an openly pro-Russian party, you know, like it's not even that it's like anti-war.
Yeah, so I think that's important to you know, it's important to draw that distinction, right? Like, journalists, you know, it's sort of the horseshoe theory journalists and, you know, sort of discourse makers love saying, oh, the far right and the far left are all the same and they both love Russia. It's like, no, that's not where the KPÖ is coming from at all. You know, we're opposed to NATO and we're opposed to, you know, Putin's Russia. You know, we're for Austrian neutrality and we're for peace. And it's really as simple as it sounds, I would say. You know, we recognize that, or, you know, according to our analysis, you know, NATO expansion was a major historical factor that made a conflict like this more likely. And, you know, the invasion of Ukraine was, you know, illegal, you know, a crime, and, you know, absolutely must be condemned, you know, categorically. And also, we're for a ceasefire because we see this war as hurting working people above all. You know, on both sides. Of course, the Ukrainians are being hurt the most, and you know it's important to say that as well. But we think a ceasefire and diplomacy is really the only viable way forward.
Yeah. And then so as well, along with the, you know, Russia just invasion in general of like having, I think, a just strict anti-war policy is always, you know, good. And, you know, I mean, I think that that's it's from my perspective, the KPÖ's position seems like a pretty, you know, genuine and sincere and historically, you know, well-reflected position, especially from where Austria stands politically. What other than like in terms of, again, you mentioned housing in, you know, these specific cities, but in other aspects of like the cost of living crisis for Germany, I mean, we know like the gas bills have gone through the roof. I know plenty of people who personally received 4-digit gas bills that they had to pay back at the beginning of this year. How has then the cost of living crisis affected Austria, and how is then this and on top of rents and all this kind of stuff then pushed that? Because on local policy, this makes a lot of sense for rents, but what about then the other general problems that the KPÖ seems to have been like reacting to? It feels like also with quite positive feedback in recent months.
Yeah. So I mean, I think the KPÖ is, you know, as a party that's really only strong on the municipal level and to some extent now also on the state level, is really limited in the things that it can do to counter the cost of living crisis, because the factors at play are macroeconomic in nature. They have to do with inflation, which, you know, is oftentimes being driven by profiteering among multinational corporations. And, you know, I mean, even if we controlled the federal government, we would still be limited as to what we could do. We could do a lot more, but just in controlling, you know, a state house or a city hall, you're even more limited. Nonetheless, the KPÖ in Graz, you know, the one place where it actually holds power, has tried to do what it can. I mentioned, you know, they chose, from 2021 into 2022, after, you know, winning power in the city of Graz, they didn't increase, you know, the municipal costs. So the fees for municipal services, you know, they expanded the people who the eligibility pool for the quote unquote social card, which they created back in 2012. And it's a card that gives people with limited income so access to either cost reduced or free social services, such as public transportation. Now, one thing that the KPÖ has also done is, you know, this hasn't immediately taken. I mean, this will take some years to bear fruition, but they've you know, built new public housing in order to counter you know, sort of this, you know, to make rent more affordable for people. Another thing the party does is they hold office hours for people for all constituents, but at these office hours they provide direct need to people.
What is this? Yeah, because you mentioned these things earlier too, and the direct need one was the one that kind of like struck me as the most the most interesting of what does that look like? How is this then? Because like this isn't like a new tactic, of course. This is a quite old tactic of communists from way yesteryear. I mean, the Italian communists notoriously did this kind of like most notably, but I guess other communist parties too. But what does then this look like in 2024, not like in like the 1930s, 1950s or whatever, you know?
Yeah, so you can literally go to office hours of EKK, the KPÖ mayor of Graz, and talk, or, you know, if you're in a financial crisis, if you're experiencing a financial emergency, such as your landlord is threatening to put you out on the street, because you haven't been able to, because you're a few months behind on your rent, the KPÖ will do stuff like, pay your outstanding rent. And you know, if you, say you're, an elderly person who, needs a new pair of glasses and you can't afford that pair of glasses, the KPÖ will transfer money to your bank account so that you can purchase a pair of glasses, simple things like that. Sort of helping people deal with, sort of slightly bigger things like, back rent, but also sort of smaller things like everyday costs that, people who are receiving, sort of the minimum pension, might not really be able to afford or only be able to afford with great difficulty, especially if the rent has been raised three times in the past 2 years, which is the case with a lot of people in Austria since the inflation crisis started. But office hours aren't only about providing people with money. They're also about, in some circumstances, the party will be able to point people towards resources or help them fill out forms to get them aid through sort of official institutional channels and situations like that. But the reason that the party does this is, they don't just do it to be good people or because they want to do charity or anything like that. You know, they host these office hours. They hold these office hours so that they can come into contact basically with working people, with people who are struggling to meet their day-to-day needs. And through this contact, they learn about, what some of the biggest problems are that people are dealing with. And this actually helps them know which policies to campaign on come the next election cycle. It helps them know, where they should be concentrating most of their focus, what issues they should be emphasizing in their political communication and stuff like that.
And so the office hours then, I mean, it seems like they've been quite well received then if this has been going quite well, as you mentioned in Graz, that the feedback has been quite well. I know this sounds really stupid, but are these type of office hours things something that were like offered in other like mayoral or other districts in Austria, or is this strictly a policy that the KPÖ like campaigned on, that we will have an open office hour sort of system, or is this kind of like a political tradition that then just has existed in Austria?
So this is something that the KPÖ started doing back really it goes back to the 1980s in the Styrian branch of the KPÖ in particular. So in the 1980s or possibly the early 1990s, in the city of Graz, the KPÖ started basically a hotline, a telephone hotline for people who were having issues with their landlords. So if you're having, if your landlord isn't, if something's broken in your apartment and your landlord isn't answering phone calls, say your window is broken and your window won't close properly and it's January, and you are having trouble affording your heating bill, or you're in a super cold apartment, you could call, or your landlord is, you know, just ripping you off and threatening to kick you out of your apartment. You could call the cop, and basically what the cop would do is they would put you in touch with, legal advice, you know, lawyers who, sort of had a relationship with the party, and they try to get you some, you know, somebody who, could give you tips and advise you on what to do in that situation. Also at the time, and after implementing this policy, the Kalpiung Graz ended up winning a seat on the city council, so the Gemeinderat, for the first time in a couple decades. And this happened, I think it was 1988. And the KPU politician who won that seat was this guy named Anas Kaltenecker. And Anas Kaltenecker was also very handy. He was, you know, good at fixing things. So, you know, when people would call this renter's hotline, he would go to their apartments and, you know, repair their broken window. Repair their leaky faucet. Yeah.
No, like he would just go himself and do that. What an absolute baller.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my
God. He really, and the reason he did this, I mean, of course he did it, you know, out of, you know, sort of this, you know, this communist principle of helping people. Sure. That was a part of it, you know, solidarity, between working people, but also, by, sort of having, you know, coming into contact with people, he, would also, learn about their problems. You know, maybe they're having a problem with their landlord, but maybe they also have some other problems. And this would inform, his politics and the KPU's politics. So it's, you know, productive for, you know, the people who are receiving direct aid, but it's also productive for the party because it helps them, you know, it keeps them grounded, you know, it helps them refine their focus and, you know what issues people are, you know, people are dealing with, you know, it prevents them from, not that doing a Lenin reading group isn't also a very valuable activity in its own right, but
I'm sold on communist handymen who also are your like representative. That's the coolest politic I've ever heard.
And this was one guy. This was Anas Kaltenecker, and Anas Kaltenecker in Graz. He basically, well, I don't want to say single-handedly, but in large part because of his own initiative, you know, his own sort of communist driven initiative, really built the credibility of this pretty minor party and, made it something that, people really associated the KPU with him. They're like, oh, this guy who like fixed my sink, he's running for the Gemeinderat. So I'm going to vote communist. You know, maybe I'm not super political. Maybe I've never considered myself on the left, but, you know, I trust this guy. This guy is credible. He means what he says. Anyway, and that's sort of where the direct aid came from. And then after he became a Gemeinderat, he started hosting these office hours where he would, meet with constituents and hear about their problems. And this approach was so successful that eventually the KPU ends up getting, you know, they go from getting 3% to 6% to 10% by the late 90s in Graz. And when they get to I think it was 8% or 10%, that's enough. That was a great enough share of the vote to win the KPU a seat on the so-called city senate, which is the executive body that governs the city of Graz. Seats on this body are awarded proportionally, so according to the total vote share of the party. I think members of the at the time members of the city senate earned something like 6,000 euro per month brutto. And what Anas Kaltenecker did was he said, I'm only going to take home 2,000 euro. Everything that all of my salary that's over that, I'm going to donate to a social fund that the party is going to administer, and we're going to use the money from this fund to help people do things like pay their back rent or buy a new pair of dentures or anything else, things of that nature. Pay for a babysitter if they need to, help a a single mother afford childcare in the afternoons or something like that. And of course, this was very well received. So this tradition that Kaltenecker started, eventually the KPU ends up winning a second seat on the city senate, and then now they have four seats on the city senate. I believe there are seven seats in total, and they have four of those seven seats. And all of the Capoeira politicians, you know, they implemented, the party implements this policy where you have to, if you want to be a Capoeira politician, you have to donate all of the salary you get from your political office. That's more than what the average tradesperson earns in Austria. So that's, you know, I think now it's like just over 2,000 euro, like 2,200, 2,300 euro. And then the rest of the money goes to the social fund that's used to directly help people. Yeah. So that's a bit where that tradition comes from.
That's amazing. That's really, I'm fascinated by Kaltenecker, you said his name was?
Yeah, Ernest Kaltenecker. There's actually a documentary about him that was made, I believe in the early 2000s. I think it's just called, I think it's just called Der Kommunist or something like that. I'll look it up and see if I can send it to you after the recording.
Please do. Well, I think that the one last thing that I just wanted to ask before we go is, I guess not like really kind of tying into then, you know, maybe the optimism of you know, kind of like the high that we're on after this W. But what would, I guess, like from your observation with this type of politic and with this type of organizing and whatnot, like what have you kind of seen is like the thing that kind of keeps this momentum going, I guess, in the sense of like has it been has there been a lot of people coming into the party like all of a sudden? Has like membership drastically increased? Is there like is there a general feel of optimism within like organizers and stuff because of these, or is it just simply a fluke that we're going to keep coasting for as long as we possibly can? Or are we seeing actual like people joining like the party, you know, because the KPÖ clearly offers some, you know, feasible and quite like material alternative, I think, that we'd see with these, you know, the one example of governance. I hope that then Salzburg, you know, that they also, you know, can be productive there. I mean, they're not, they most likely won't be heading that government or heading that mayorship, but you know, I mean, it is at least they will be governing, is very clear. But yeah, like has there been some momentum towards the KPÖ? You know, the Austrian right, I don't think that we'll have enough time to talk about today. That'll be a whole, I mean, there's multiple elections coming up. I know that we can, either talk with you or another comrade about the situation with the, you know, how the Austrian right looks, but simply staying on the good vibes, or maybe not good vibes, I don't know. Is there, yeah, like just back to my very simple thing, is are people being attracted to this outside of Graz and outside of Salzburg? Like, what does, you know, what does organizing look like in the party right now?
Yes. So outside of, I guess that's a lot of different questions, but I guess I'll start by saying, I don't think that the KPÖ's successes in Salzburg would have been possible this quickly without the success in Graz in 2021. So I see sort of a direct line from Graz in 2021, then the Salzburg state parliament election in 2023, sort of that surprise, very strong result, to the Salzburg city council election and mayor election, which happened last week. Yeah, I definitely think the success of the comrades in Salzburg has fed on the, you know, it's benefited from the positive PR that the government in Graz has generated. Also, the party in Salzburg is successful because they've modeled, at least in my opinion, I think their success has to do with the fact that they've pursued the approach of the comrades in Graz. The party in Graz and in Styria has this really nice motto. In German, it's, I hope I don't mess it up. Eine nützliche Partei für das tagtägliche Leben der arbeitenden Menschen und der größten Ziele der Arbeiterbewegung. So, a useful party for the day-to-day life of working people and for the grand goals of the labor movement. And I think, I mean, it doesn't sound, I mean, it's a bit of a mouthful, I guess.
It is a bit of a mouthful, but it's nice, you know, so it's...
their idea, like, eine nützliche Partei, a useful party. They want to be useful in regular people's everyday lives and everyday lives of working people. And they also want to be of use for furthering or for, you know, realizing sort of that long-term perspective of a society beyond capitalism. So this sort of ideological linkage between sort of the everyday grassroots, sort of almost microscopic, you know, helping people in whatever way you can with, regardless of however limited your resources might be, even if that means going to somebody's apartment and, you know, using sort of your own skills to, you know, at repairing things to help them repair their sink, you know, as they were doing back in the 1980s and 1990s, or whether that means, you know, helping pay back somebody's rent, you know, helping somebody pay their back rent or whatever. But also linking, you know, sort of these, you know, these instances of basic solidarity with, you know, the vision or the idea of a society beyond capitalism, and talking about, you know, having a party program that has the word Enteignung in it, that talks about Enteignung der Großkonzerne, you know, expropriating, you know, major corporations, and not sort of giving up their, you know, basically being true to themselves, you know, as people who are critical of capitalism, as anti-capitalists, as Marxists, and not being afraid to sort of do both at the same time. People in the party. So I was at the there was a party conference back in November, early November, to plan for the quote unquote super election year 2024, the mega election year 2024. And our two leading candidates, you know, they were sort of presented on stage. You know, we voted ultimately we ended up electing them to be our two leading candidates, but they're presented to us by the party executive as sort of the candidates of the party executive, you know, our democratically elected party executive had suggested or proposed to the membership to then, you know, be confirmed by the membership. And, you know, they're presented as Experten des Alltags, so like experts of everyday life. You know, the top candidate is, you know, a young guy named Tobias Schweiger. And, you know, he, you know, was an activist with the Young Greens, before 2017. The Young Greens ended up getting kicked out of the Green Party for basically criticizing the membership for being too neoliberal. They were more interested in doing sort of a solid, you know, a class politics of solidarity, and the membership wasn't having that, so they got booted. So the Young Greens ended up campaigning for the COP here in 2017 during the federal election that year, and then changing their, or basically refounding their youth organization into the Junge Linke, the Young Left, and then ultimately in 2022 becoming sort of the formal youth organization of the KPÖ. Yeah, so, you know, we do see the party start to attract new members even as far back as 2017. And then, you know, the second candidate for Nationalrat is a woman who works as a nurse on an ICU, a woman named Bettina Prohaska. Yeah, she's an ICU nurse. She, you know, is a mother. You know, she's not, you know, she doesn't have your typical profile of a, you know, your typical politician profile, right? You know, she is a nurse. she's not a I don't know, sort of a party functionary, or
will she come and fix my sink though, is the
yeah.
but I mean, like, that is definitely, like, I mean, that is definitely very cool that a party, I mean because even if you want to look into the sense of, like, you know, like a party like Die Linke, the Spitzenkandidat is always someone who's just a politician.
Usually it's career politicians, or I mean, and, you know, even in Toby's case, I mean, Toby's been sort of involved in, I guess you could say, party politics for a long time, and he's a young guy, he's in his early 30s, but he does things in the KPÖ, like, you know, he, like in Vienna, you know, helped, like, he's also like a super handy guy, and he helped, like, renovate, one of the party's district organizations. And he does things like, during their Volksküche, when the Kapu district organizations will have like sort of an open house where you can come and get like a free hot meal. He'll do things like cook. So that's like this idea of like experts of everyday life.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
So, Adam, I really appreciate you coming on here and chatting about this, about the copy and this just, surprise of the last few years, especially kind of on the back of it feels that then everything is so, I can just say it just feels really shit. It's nice to see that then that there is this, kind of like reinvigorated, a type of hyper localized politic that it feels that left wing communist ideals, whatever you want to call them, can actually be realized in a way that then is grasping very day to day issues. And it's nice seeing in the sense that then of the like typical navel gazing that we get from the left, that we actually have, what seems to be a quite successful model for hopefully, leading Austria and the rest of Europe, towards, some form of something better. It does seem really local, but at the same time, that is a form of politic that is going to most affect you day to day. So, hopefully that catches on, but thank you so much for coming on, again, so quickly. And, before we go, where can, or is there anything that you want to plug, and, where can our listeners find you?
If people want to read more about the Kapu, they can, check out my author page at Jacobin. And beside that, I'm on Twitter and sometimes I tweet.
All right, Adam, thank you so much. And to our listeners, we will see you guys all for the bonus episode. Take care.